So, today felt like the opening of a novel for me. I go in to town, it's raining, but whatever. I need to pick up three things. I don't even remember all three. They're kind of obscure things.
If they're obscure things, then you would remember them probably.
You do remember them, but you don't rem always. But like the way obscure things are, you don't always remember them at the moment you need to remember them. But I made a point of one thing. So last Saturday, as you know, I like to have my little Saturday chill nights. I got a nice little lava lamp, a little novelty. Susan got it for me a couple years ago. I had it down in LA actually. So I go to flip it on. It flips on. It's one of those turn switches. So when you flip it on, half the time you roll too fast and it flips it on, turns it off, turns it on, turns it off. It did that, but it also looked like it burned out. And I'm like, oh no, and it burned out. And I'm like, I never put together. Oh, that's right. This thing has a bulb. Eventually, this bulb will die. So I had to makeshift something for
Even
my
though you hadn't used it
evening.
before, or you
I'd used
had
it a
used it?
bunch, but
Oh,
I use
okay.
it, maybe 10 hours a week at most. So today I knew I had to. I on my epic hunt for these bulbs. First it's scouring Saturday night, thinking maybe the grocery store would have it. Probably not. I didn't bother going to the grocery store. I thought that was a fool's folly. It was a T7 15-watt bulb. So today I knew I'm going to see this movie. Going to see Inherent Vice with Zach. Gonna go into Arcata. There's the hardware store right there. I'll just saunter down before the movie real quick, pop in and get one. So I did that. But I've also had a rip in the seat of my car, in the driver's seat, for quite a while. Like the stitching kind of came out right in the middle. So far it hasn't gotten much worse. I've been lucky. But I knew I needed to get like some black duct tape because it's a black seat, just to kind of, tape it together, hold it together, but not be too gaudy about it. So I get my black duct tape, I get my bulbs, and then as I'm leaving and I start walking one way, I'm like, oh, wait. Usually every year for Christmas, I get sort of a nice calendar. My mom gets me one or something. Sometimes it's cool images of like old passenger train ads from the 30s or something. And I'm like, I know the place to get them's right here on the plaza, which is, a block away from the movie. So I got, it's 105. I'm like, I don't know. I run down there and I gotta peruse. I gotta check them all out. There's some cool wood block ones and there's some regular whatevers. I opted for kind of a safe and easy bet. I just went with a hopper, because that kind of fits the motif of my room. So I get that all taken care of and that's great. I got this bag with lava lamp bulbs, black duct tape, and then I've got this Hopper pay calendar, so I've got that to contest with while I sit in the theater. And thankfully, you helped me. You held them for me while
Yeah, I held you for like 3 seconds.
I used the facility. Yeah, so like I said, it was just one of those like that'd be something that you'd start a novel with, I'm walking in the rain back to my car with the smell of somebody's food in front of me, kind of thing. This felt like a very very
We
effervescent
need to read more
page.
novels.
Speaking of novels, Inherent Vice, Thomas Pynchon novel, about a, I guess a stoner PI in the 70s in LA and his misadventures. So Zach, what did you think of Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice?
What did I think of it?
Well, you could check your Twitter Kindle
What did
and
I think of
see what
it?
it tells you to think of it. Do you want me to ask what did you feel of it?
Think of it?
What did you see of it? What did you smell of it?
What did I think of it? What did I think of it? What did I think of it? I thought it was very, very good. I liked it a lot.
That's a lot of
I loved it.
equivocating up till
I
that.
loved it.
Loved it.
I loved it.
Wow.
It was probably something I need to see another time. But it was very funny. It held my attention all the way through, despite the length.
And despite you checking your phone about 8 times.
I was just checking the time.
Because it didn't help you, didn't really hold your attention, did it?
I was like, no, it really did. I was just making sure what the time was. Hello. Hey, what's up? Yeah, it's like,
a little Ian time while Zach takes his phone call. Inherent Vice falls into a category of stuff that I very much so find I like. It's a detective story. It's set in that window of 50s, 60s, early 70s, you know? The early 70s is essentially the 60s, kind of like the early 80s is essentially the 70s, the early 90s is essentially the 80s. We all know that the decade cultural shifts take about 2 to 3 years.
Yes.
And so in that sense, I definitely, this was my kind of stuff. This is, this is to Chinatown. This is Long Goodbye in a lot of ways. I found it engaging in those senses. I mean, what Zach won't admit, apparently, is that it was too long. Anderson has always been self-indulgent, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's never ruins a picture for him. I don't think there's a single one of his movies I really dislike at all. But this movie could have pretty easily been about 25 minutes shorter. It did have the problem of feeling like it ended about 3 times before it finally did, and that's always tough, especially when you're pushing 2.5 hours. So that's my general 2 cents. That's what I thought about it. But let's get into the real meat and potatoes here. So, you did check your phone multiple times because you wanted to know what time it was. So you were kind of removed from it.
I feel
like we have to make that point. Or is this a parental thing? Because that's a fair cop out if it's like
I always have a parental thing.
Right. So as a father now,
I check my phone just curiously to see what time it is multiple times during the movie to see if I've gotten any texts about the kids or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fine then. Then I'll not contest your engagement with the picture.
You shouldn't.
Fine.
You have no right.
Well, I mean, it's just something I observed.
You observed wrongly.
Well, no, I think I interpreted wrongly.
Yeah, that's it. You interpreted wrongly.
Okay.
So what were you telling?
I was talking about how this is totally in my wheelhouse of material with detective stories. I love detective stories. This is a Rockford File episode.
I just don't understand Chinatown, Long Goodbye. The hatred for it by so many people.
There's going on in this movie? Absolute hatred. People are hating?
People hate it hard. Like,
is it just as
dumb? It's split 50-50 between people who were like, I don't know what it meant. I don't know what the point was, but I loved it. And then people who were like, this is a miserable, worthless waste of time that I don't understand why.
Right.
Pynchon wrote it, and I don't understand why Anderson directed and adapted and directed it.
It's the sub genre. I would say, and it's a little tricky here. So you start with film noirs, and you have the PI that is part of the system but not part of the system. Now, as the culture changes and the landscape changes, and you get into the 60s and the 70s, the PI is going to change too, a little bit, quite a bit. So it's not Humphrey Bogart and Maltese Falcon. It's, you know, it's Elliot Gould in Long Goodbye. I mean, it's even to a degree Jack Nicholson in Chinatown.
I haven't really read in depth any reviews of it. I just know the general tenor of them. And I don't know how many people just kind of thought it was a rehash of The Big Lebowski, because it's very, very similar in tone and everything else. It's really a lot like that. It's just exactly a mix between Big Lebowski and what's it called?
Long Goodbye. Yeah.
They're both set in L.A. and one of them has a lot more beach in it, and they're both kind of funny, and they both are. I mean, Long Goodbye is obviously more of an actual detective film because it's a direct adaptation of an actual Raymond Chandler, but like, they're still convoluted and about 50,000 plot threads leaving out, and I didn't find this hard to follow at all. People were talking about how hard to follow it was, and that was the one thing that disengaged so many people from it. It was incredibly hard to follow, and I don't even like are these people that haven't seen any detective movies? Have they not seen any Raymond Chandler adaptations? Have they not seen The Big Lebowski? Have they not seen, like, it's that same sort of thing? I don't understand. And this is just about as much about. I mean, I can't speak for the Pynchon, but in terms of Anderson, it's like, you know, he's made these movies about they're set like at the end of an era, you know, like Boogie Nights is, for instance. It's at the end of the age of innocence and pornography, and it's turning into a new age, but it's still people holding on to the old thing. And in this case, it's like, the, you know, 1970 is a changing time. The hippie movement was, you know, the people who still had buzz cuts and so forth and still dressed in 60s bobs and stuff like that, they were still there, but it was like coming to an end. Like, all of that was coming to an end. It was a culture shift and a culture change. And a good movie is something that isn't just about the plot. And this isn't about the plot. And
right.
Big Lebowski wasn't about the plot. And, you know, none of those good movies are about the plot.
No, I mean...
I was generally confused. I thought it was great.
I'll say, by the end of it and throughout, I had trouble following it at points, but I was almost always able to kind of catch up. It would be like I'd miss a name or I'd miss a reference and then be like, oh wait, so who is it? So what is it? So definitely seeing it another time, I think I'll follow it a little better. But by the end of it, I kind of got where it was going. And I also know, just knowing the genre, that it's a noir staple. There is no Upshot. Chinatown, right. Long Goodbye, even Big Lebowski, there is no Upshot.
It's generally about people who are compelled to finish the task even when it's been told to them multiple times. It's just like, it's like the detective's a certain type of person that, despite what else is going on in their life and despite what you know, personality they have or what they're into, like for instance, this guy is just a complete stoner who can barely function half the time. He can barely talk.
I want to talk about that.
I think it's really funny that he couldn't talk through most of the movie. There's no detective movie where the detective isn't compelled to follow every thread till the end, whether or not it's ostensibly over.
Right.
And that's what happens in this. Yeah. That's what happens in all of them.
So I feel like attacking it for plot convolution or kind of a pervasive nihilism or whatever people might sort of draw out from this, it's nothing new, and so it's part of the genre. It'd be like attacking a rom-com for having a hokey meet cute or something. It's like, no, that's what they do in those. Yeah, you speak to him about him being a stoner, and that was my biggest trepidation, is how much of this is going to just be like broad comedy stoner laugh bullshit, and how much of it's going to, like, how good of a detective can he be as a character? How compelled will I be in terms of the detective story? Because that's where I land. I'm not huge on stoner comedy stuff. Pineapple Express was fun, but I think that was... I mean, you know, it is what it is. I think it says a lot, though, that just this character is a stoner in the 70s and not a stoner now. And, you know, weed is much, much stronger now than it was then. So I feel like he's not as crazy. And they also make a point of saying... And this goes to your idea, your concept about the death of the hippie movement, is that, yeah, they're not just, they smoke a little grass. It's like they smoke grass and most of them shoot up H.
Well, I think they differentiated between that and the people who are actual, like, dope users.
Right.
And in that case, that was like, I don't know. I mean, there was definite culture there, but that detective, in all those movies, you know, I mean, there's three movies now, at least, where... The three we've already mentioned there, including this, where, like, it's... These detectives are in... They live in the subculture. Whether or not, you know, the Elliot Gould character was, a pothead or whatever, it is kind of irrelevant. But he lived in the culture. He knew all these people.
Right.
And he was friends with all these people. And
you have to be.
And that's how he was able to move in and out of the world. And that's right. How it is going all the way back to the stuff set in the 40s and even the stuff set in the 30s, you know, and the stuff that Dashiell Hammett did. Where it was set even earlier than that, like they were people who lived in the seedy underbelly, and were well acquainted with it, and were in whatever subculture was there. Then they were paid by people who were essentially their friends or at least acquaintances to help find people and stuff like that. You know,
it even starts with a girl comes into his not his office, but you know,
his home. Yeah.
His home. So it's got a lot of the go-to tropes. I don't think it's poking. Maybe critics were hoping there would be something more meta about it. And it would be less on the nose as just sort of... But I felt it was a very straightforward for its genre, kind of well-made...
I read a review in one of the major papers, I forget which one, and it was like... It was one of those ones where, like, it singles out the acting performances, which I had never really think that much about, because acting performances are generally always good in a good movie, because you have a good director, you have good actors, that makes good acting, you know, like, it's really not that difficult to come by. But there was something in particular where they're like, this person was good, and then there was
whoever, like this girl who played the sister of a character was just like the person couldn't act. But I recognized who that was as a porn star. The girl who comes into his office and shares his laughing gas.
Right.
That was I think that's her first time ever acting. That's some porn chick.
Playing the sister?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so like the reviewer was complaining about the acting of the porn person. And that's multiple times now that Paul Thomas Anderson, who came from the Valley and was obsessed with porn growing up, like at a very young age, like 11, was always wanting to cast porn stars in things. And Boogie Nights is full of actual porn actors in various roles. And so for whatever reason, he insisted that, you know, they do that. They didn't need to. They could throw in the actor. Now, this thing is a very large cast, huge cast of people.
That's part of it, why it's going to seem convoluted, because there's a lot going on.
Maybe, but I, like I said, I wasn't confused at all.
I'm not saying
I thought the acting was good all the way around. And everything,
I didn't mind the sister. I didn't find a problem with it.
Well, for whatever reason, the person in one review pointed out that person and was like, yeah, that person was a really bad actor. I don't know. Like, I don't know what Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right.
Anyway, all that stuff out of the way, then I just don't see what.
Yeah, you don't see what the why everyone's getting so negative on it.
I don't see why anyone could be negative at all. And I don't know. There's a really good reviewer. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize in criticism a couple years ago, named Wesley Morris, and he had a really good review of Inherent Vice when it first came out, limited release, and he spoke to it being something where you take it all in as a whole, and how he watched it twice to come to that conclusion, and you know, it's breathtaking. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, and you know this because you always do this to certain directors. You want certain directors who've done things that you admire to continue making those things. You want Ridley Scott to always make sci-fi. That's what you want, personally. And so people who love P.T. Anderson want him to continue to make whichever of the films they loved by him. You know, because he's gone in different different directions already.
I've liked most of the things he's done. Already. I think he's always had... every single movie he's made from Sydney on have all been plot light. And they're character pieces to some degree. They're about one person negotiating or navigating a universe or a world.
Well, you could argue in that way that they're all kind of plot heavy, because the plot ends up not being an A to B thing. It ends up being an A to all the way through Z thing.
Well, but the plot isn't the thing that drives the whole nature of whether or not you enjoy the movie, I guess is what I say. That's what I mean. And just
they're generally just about a person.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I like. I like those kinds of stories. That's the sort of stuff Seth likes. That's why he likes There Will Be Blood and stuff. I don't know what he would like this one. I think he was disappointed with The Master. I was a little disappointed with The Master. I like this more than The Master because it's my genre. Mm-hmm. I love this stuff. I love this setting of this time period. I love the look. That said, I mean, Anderson has always been self-indulgent, and when it works, fine, just like Tarantino. When it doesn't, you know, whatever. And I feel like this movie probably could have been 20 minutes shorter without it losing anything. And I felt like the editing in a couple of spots, it felt a little abrupt and a little sloppy, but that could have also been entirely on purpose to fit the character and his whole mindset.
Yeah.
I can see a lot of these...
I don't see anything that was sloppy. In fact, I was thinking about the parts that I liked most of all in the movie were the parts that didn't need to be in it that should have been cut. I liked those. Like the scenes where there's voiceover talking about the thing that's not happening on the screen.
Right.
Like when he slowly, out of the corner of his eye, notices that Bjornsson is deep-throating a chocolate-covered banana in the car as he drives him. And this just weird look of disgust slowly crosses his face, and he just like, and that shot goes on for like 25 seconds while the voiceover about something else is happening.
No, I mean, the voiceover stuff was all good.
That was kind of an interesting idea too, which is to have his assistant character, which wasn't really made clear that it was his assistant, but it is the one telling the voiceover, and even sometimes on camera telling the voiceover, which is Pinchon's
dialogue. Those are some really great bits. The voiceover does feel literary, but you know, so what? And of course, the whole idea is whether or not she exists, because she never interacts with anyone else, right? It's someone in his mind, in his drug-addled mind, and they play that concept a couple times with like, is this a hallucination he's having, or is this for real? And the funny part is, it all ends up being real. You know, you see his his cop sort of buddy, his frenemy or whatever, doing an ad on TV, and you're thinking, is he imagining him there? And it's like, no, he's that guy, apparently the guy's in SAG, and he does stuff like this. So it's just a ridiculous coincidence.
That was a really well written relationship also between him and what's his name's character?
Brolin. Yeah, that was
Bjornsson. Really good. Brolin's character was awesome. And he had a ton of depth. That character had a ton of depth. The brief things they showed, the brief little shots of him at home, the one with him and his kid, the one with him and his wife, just fleshed out that character so much. And he was just such a seething ball of rage. And then he was also very friendly and helpful at times, like begrudgingly so. But like you could tell that they had a deeper relationship.
He knew about doing the right thing, and he had been. I mean, there was a whole past there with his partner getting killed, him being on his own, and kind of like this revenge plot he was sort of biding his time for, and he was, you know, at some point you get a sense that he was using Doc to help him arrive there, help him get there, which was a part that I think I'm still like, I need to see it again to see how that connects, that those dots all completely connect, because I'm a little confused about like how
Bjornsson showed up there.
No, not even that, because that part I think I can follow, because of your car was parked illegally, so that means he knows where he went in front of so-and-so's office, so he was able to track that. I forget the guy's name, but the guy with the baseball bat.
Adrian something.
Yeah, Adrian. But I'm not sure how Adrian connected then to the Golden Triangle, necessarily. It seemed like Adrian kind of worked for the PD. And I guess maybe the idea is just that it's all so corrupted, and it's all so folded in on itself. Yeah. But like I said, you know, that stuff you can sort out. That's plot stuff you can sort it out on the next viewing or something. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily any particular scenes. It's just a few, like I said, the self-indulgence comes in just a few moments of just being precious about holding on a shot 4 seconds too long. Or things that probably could have gone, but I don't think would have affected not even the plot, but the characters or whatever else. It's just, there's bits there, and I'm pretty sure that in a 2 hour and 28 minute movie, 20 minutes of that probably, it would have added up to about 20 minutes if you could have parted down. And it would have been less looking at your phone. It would have been, in my case...
That really bothers you, didn't it?
No, I'm just, not really.
It really bothers you. It's bothering you a lot.
It's bothering me so much. No, it does, you will have to agree here that knowing what I know about the genre and sort of the idea of like bookends and everything else, when the girl comes back and he's on the couch and it's like, this is how the movie started, I'm like, this is how the movie's gonna end. It's gonna be some conversation.
I
thought that was gonna be the
I
end.
I absolutely
of the
knew it wasn't gonna end right there because
you looked at your phone and knew that there was still an hour.
No, I wasn't paying attention to the time at all. Because nothing had actually happened.
Right, but that could also be the upshot of the story too.
I knew that there was going to be some blood spilled. There absolutely had to be, because there isn't one of those where blood isn't spilled.
Okay,
which is one of the jokes about the Big Lebowski, is that no blood ends up being spilled until the completely pointless brawl in the parking lot at the very end,
or the toe.
Yeah, but that was like that's not, you know.
No, you're right. But that's what I'm saying. Like, that isn't a hard and fast like rule, and Anderson could break from that. So people are gonna think Seth's on here now.
That's not his calling card.
That is. I think he made it that at some point. So yeah, I mean, I think it could have, but even 10 minutes or 20 minutes shorter. I mean, it's tough. It's more a theater thing. That wasn't the most comfortable theater, and it was small.
Yeah, that theater sucks.
Where did we see? We saw Llewellyn Davis in the same one, or
we saw Llewellyn Davis in the big one.
Yeah. See, that's a better theater. And
it's a better theater, but I don't like the seats on the bottom. And if you sit on the top, no matter where you are, the railing on the balcony just kind of covers the bottom inch of the screen. It bugs the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's not. I like being able to just dart into Arcata and do some errands and walk into a movie. It feels very, very much like a. It feels very small towny, you know?
Yeah.
But
small towny for sure.
The theater quality, it's not terrible. I mean, it's just freaking. I couldn't believe how many people came on a rainy Saturday to the 1 o'clock showing, too. People kept trickling in throughout all the damn trailers.
They wanted to see it.
And we're like, oh, right. What? Oh, if I get here after the movie started, I have to stand and figure out where to go. And. Oh well, they all were polite. That was fine. We didn't have any.
No one can live without Ian being bothered.
Can
by
they
it,
live?
Yeah.
No,
they're just trying to live.
Just show up on time.
No, people can't do that. What if they were coming in? What if they were heading in from the hospital?
It's true. They all had scrubs on. I didn't. I didn't recognize.
What if they were heading in from, you know, they were driving
important meetings?
They were on their way to get to the movie early, and then suddenly there was a car crash and they were stuck on the freeway. Should they have thought after they waited there for 10 minutes, like, oh, I shouldn't go in late? What if I get there and the movie's only gonna start like after 2 more trailers? What if I bug somebody sitting in there?
Right.
That's what they should have thought, right?
I leave early on that same exact
count. Yeah, but what if you get caught even though you leave early? What if you get held up?
You plan for me. I plan for disaster all the time.
By leaving like 17 hours early to things?
If it's 17 hours, then you've already lost your point, haven't you? They're not going to make it to the movie 5 minutes late because it was a 17-hour delay. You know, you leave 10 minutes of buffer for things. This is what people do. We live in a society. What's the phrase? Early is on time. On time is late.
I don't know what you're talking about, man.
Nah, most people don't. It's okay. We'll see. Take it as a sign.
Benicio del Toro.
He was good. He was the right kind of, like, a character. It wasn't too much. Which fit Fear and Loathing. And he wasn't too understated. Yeah. Like, he was just the right amount, yeah. It was, like you said, I think Anderson, with good actors, just... He gets to do the best possible thing. Phoenix was really good.
One thing I noticed was even the waitress who has like 2 lines with them and when they're in that bar.
From Workaholics?
Yes. It was, what's her name?
It's Jillian.
Jillian.
Well, that's what they call her.
That's her name. Her name is Jillian.
Oh, okay.
Her name is Jillian, whatever, yeah.
She's good.
Yeah. I noticed she only had like, you could just see like the corner of her chin. I can still tell.
I wonder what was up with his framing in a lot of shots. He just purposely decided to not see people. Didn't get to see his,
Bjornsson's
Bjornsson's wife ever. She just becomes this great. Like and set of legs in a bag.
The guy who Eric Roberts' wife is banging. He enters the room. You just see his torso for a while, and then he turns around and sits, and you can't see him either until they finally.
But then you do see him
eventually. Yeah.
So it's kind of
like that's just good. That's just good direction.
Well, like it's fine if it's like that. But like the other ones, you kind of feel like you're catching the bottom of someone's mouth. I don't know. I would have framed things a little differently.
Yeah, you also would have shown up on time to the theater.
And I would have shown up on time to the theater. But I mean, I didn't have any too big of a problem with it. It was it wasn't overly stylized. It was the appropriate look and feel, which I think he's able to do. He was able to do that in There Will Be Blood and The Master and in this. It just kind of capture, because those are the ones I feel like are almost kind of period movies, I guess. And they had to kind of fit a certain quality and tonality and mood visually in terms of the set design and the cinematography and everything else. And it's got it there. I might take umbrage with the font. I felt like that was a little too... Like, it was like a neon whatever. They didn't just...
It's
just
the font from the cover of the book.
Well, but it doesn't really gel with the actual what you see in the movie. There's not a lot of, like, neon nightclub scenes. They mention Vegas, but they never go to Vegas. It's all, like, beach area LA stuff. I don't know. To me, it just doesn't...
Are we seriously talking about the font right now?
You're talking about the construction of a masterpiece here and, you know, and things that... And the decisions that were made to create it, right? Doesn't matter. Okay, fine. Plot doesn't matter. Font doesn't matter. What about the score?
Nothing matters.
Did you like that Neil Young?
That's not score.
The soundtrack.
There was score.
There was score and soundtrack. Do we know if Johnny Greenwood did the score this time?
I don't know who did the score. It was, I don't think so. It was very orchestral at the end.
Yeah, and there wasn't much to it, really. It was just kind of like it punctuated a few moments to kind of, you know, rev things up a little bit.
Yeah, there was a couple of Neil Youngs in there. There was some good stuff. Young Girls Town.
All songs about LA, huh? In the 70s, probably.
Yeah, that's where he was. He was in, actually, that one party that was in Topanga Canyon. That's where he lived for a long time. He lived in an artist's, you know, the whole area is an artist's enclave, basically. Right. And he wrote, what's that album called?
Is it Harvest or something?
No. Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. It's an 8-song album, but it's like it's kind of long because a couple of the songs go on forever. But he wrote that entire thing while he was sick and had a 103-degree fever over the course of like 8 hours. He wrote all the songs like in their entirety for that album in Topanga Canyon.
Pretty zany
that
he didn't die 103 fever.
He lived and hey, he thrived.
And he worked.
He thrived.
Yeah, he did.
There was good stuff in there, and there was great touches. It was comedic, but it was also... Apparently the novel is comedic.
Of course, it would have to be. I mean, you're not going to do like a stoner detective story and not have there be some aspect of absurdity to it, which would be comedic.
Music by Johnny Greenwood.
Well, there you go.
It's your boy Greenwood.
I don't know though. Not a lot to it.
There was quite a bit of score toward the end.
Right, but it didn't seem like particularly unusual or unique.
Yeah, it didn't need.
I mean, it wasn't Jerry Goldsmith, it wasn't all bombastic or anything, but.
Yeah.
Like you said, it was orchestral, which seemed like kind of a new thing for him.
It was that Family Guy thing where they went to the Porn Awards and they were talking about next up was best score, and it was like this guy for whatever movie, and it's just this sleazy guitar bass thing, and it points to this guy, and he's like, hey, and then it's like, or this guy for this other thing, and it's some other sleazy bass guitar thing. Hey.
I think they all were doing
guitars. And then the third one was, and then John Williams for whatever this porn was, yeah. And he's like sitting there at a table, and it showed him recording, and it's like a 70-piece orchestra.
Of course. Dun, 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 dun. That would be an interesting porno with that crazy orchestra.
Tons of horns.
Porno orchestra. That's got to be a hipster band name at this point, right? Check in Austin and check with your friends.
Jeez.
Your friends in
nobody hates
in Portland.
Hipsters as much as you. I think you are one. I think you're a special breed of hipster who just refuses to believe he is.
Right.
You stick so stringently to a certain lifestyle and a way of dress and when things need to be done and when and yada yada yada.
And I appreciate my culture. I appreciate my musics and my comics and my cartoons.
You're precious.
I'm like, this is the way to do it. You can't do it that way.
I saw a couple of really good movies recently.
Okay, let's wrap in on your advice, because I think we both enjoyed it a lot.
Then you're just going to throw away my other things.
You should wrap them into the... Okay, you want to wrap it in? Then we'll wrap it in. So you saw other good movies.
Yeah. I saw Whiplash, which I saw is coming to the theater soon.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Phenomenal.
Okay,
Best movie I've seen from last year.
Wow.
And then The Guest, which
I've heard good things about that.
Dan Stevens, who's fantastic in it. But it's the follow-up by the guy who made Your Next, who I was telling you about. So that director immediately went made the second one called...
Is it a sequel?
No. It's his follow-up film. Like, he immediately went... Yes, the thing, like, you know, you break it, you break big, you always got to have something in your back pocket.
Oh, yeah.
So he has it in his back pocket.
No sophomore slump. Cannot sophomore slump.
And it's weird, because it's like... It's multiple movies at once, and it's The Guest is, like, very creepy, and it's about this family who has, like, a dead soldier son slash brother. This guy comes back and says he was in his platoon, and he told him that he told their son as he was dying that he would go and he would tell them all personally that he loved them and yada yada, and then he would leave. So he shows up there, and they, like, kind of insist that he stays. And then he kind of, like, fixes their problems for them because he's a tough guy.
Right.
And they all got, like, pussy problems, basically. Like, right. You know, they're too pussy for this and that. And then it just turns into a crazy, like, action film. Like the last third of it is, like, a crazy, violent action film. It's really weird, but it's awesome. And it's incredibly creepy. It was fantastic.
Both of those have been movies I've had on my like radar to watch. And I want to see The Guest was something I thought was like on Netflix or Amazon here recently.
It might have been.
And then it's not anymore.
Yeah.
It sucks. Like I think
but I know Your Next was on there for a while too. And Your Next ends up being more of like it's more of like a home invasion thriller than it is a horror film, but it's got horror film elements to it. And it was lumped in with like the whole new batch of horror stuff last year.
That would discourage me.
But it really wasn't horror. It had some horror elements to it for sure. But that was really good too. It ended up being a lot more straightforward than I thought it was going to be. And then The Guest ends up being straightforward in some ways, and then just, like, there's some things I just didn't understand.
Well, that's funny.
But that was really good. And that Dan Stevens guy was I saw him in, I recognized him from something else I saw. I guess he's a new up-and-coming guy. But he was in that weird Walk Among the Tombstones.
Right, yeah, the Liam Neeson movie you saw.
And I think he's British. And he was played Americans in both movies that I've seen him in, so I don't know. Anyway, he's someone to look out for.
Well, that's cool that you got two winners. Nothing worse than watching a shitty movie.
Yeah, I got a few more to watch. I'm going to watch Equalizer.
That probably won't be so good.
And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I've heard
things about that. I think I talked a little bit about, I saw They Came Together. That was really good.
Yeah,
that. That was good,
I haven't been watching as many movies. I guess, it's not the stuff we watched when we watched 3 Days to Kill and stuff, which was fun.
Yeah, that was
fun. I I enjoyed that more than I thought I would, as opposed to Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, which I thought I would like more than I did. I think it's because when I saw Jack Reacher, I thought, this probably won't be so good, but it ended up being better than
so
I thought.
So anything with Jack in the title.
Yeah, exactly. 3 days to Jack. I've been watching that Marco Polo show. I got the last 3 episodes of that for the first season to finish. And I was surprised by how much of a... It's almost an adventure show. It is in places. It's like the closest thing on TV to like a show where there's like, these guys are going to go and, you know, it's Marco Polo and Kublai Khan's court. And then someone tries to assassinate him. And then it's like, you're going to have to go undercover in the walled city kind of stuff. It's a little sprinkled out. It's a little diluted. It's clearly harping on Game of Thrones kind of stuff with, you know, violence and nudity shit, which everybody feels like they have to do. I feel like if Full Metal Alchemist had a bunch of nudity and violence in it, then HBO would snatch it up to follow up Game of Thrones, you know, when that show ends, you know? But because it does, it's like, what there's some cool things that they can adapt into a live-action show that are good all-around kind of crowd-pleasing things, but I guess HBO always has to have that R-rated quality to their shit. And it doesn't really work for me always.
It's the adult channel.
Right.
It's about adults.
Right, and their adult problems. But no, so it's, I don't know, it's kind of a... It's an above mediocre kind of show that I'm just kind of plowing through. Because I like the historical fiction quality of it. Haven't seen a show about, like, Kublai Khan before. And that's kind of neat. It's got pretty good production value. It's really pretty looking. You know,
it sounds really boring.
Sweeping stuff. I talked about adventure and stuff. You just read that some guy decided not to like it for whatever political reasons.
I haven't heard that anyone likes it. Everyone hates it.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that they say it sucks.
Based on what?
It's supposed to be...
So it's just like Inherent Vice then.
It's supposed to be trite. Apparently the guy who's the main actor is terrible. He was someone who's never acted before that they picked out of
a hat?
A mass call of like 2,000 people to try and play this person. It's just getting bad reviews all around.
Yeah, I haven't read it.
And, I don't know, it probably has something built into it where like the fact that they spent so much money on it. They spent tons of money on it.
Massive
amount of money on it. Getting a second season, it's their thing.
Right. But they would if it was a loser critically and a loser financially, they would shit can it.
I'm not really sure how they can.
And a lot of that stuff is with like the Weinstein Company and stuff. Peaky Blinders is, I mean, a lot of stuff's also with BBC. They've got partnerships, so it's not just all on them in terms of determining.
Yeah, but Marco Polo is just their thing. Like
it's Weinstein.
It's their original series, is what I'm saying.
Right, but it's...
Like it's aired exclusively through them.
Right, yeah.
You know, Peaky Blinders is a BBC thing.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, I think when I finish the season, I'll see what decision I make on whether or not what I think about it. But, like I said, it's been okay. It's something to watch while you eat dinner kind of thing. It's not great. But I don't know. I don't know what people are cluing in on. Maybe they call to question the historical validity of it, which I think is kind of moot for something that's, you know, 900 years ago or whatever. It's like
you can't make up in your mind what you think unknown criticisms are and then answer them.
That's true.
Listen to yourself. Uh-huh. You're suggesting to yourself, what could the criticisms possibly be? Could they be this? And my answer to that is this.
Yeah.
That's dumb, man.
It's upsetting how often I'm right, though. Let's just be honest here. You know, you get a... I'm pretty good at gauging what people... Like with Inherent Vice, you know? It's like, okay, people might go after this for being a little convoluted, but... or it's just not their time to like Anderson. I mean, let's be honest. There's a lot of politics behind whether or not somebody decides to like something or not.
I don't think there's politics so much as the test of time ends up deciding whether things are beloved or not. And The Big Lebowski was hated when it came out.
Critically?
Critically hated.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was... People were like, what is this? Why does this exist? This is dumb. There's no resolution. There's no point. And now it's beloved. So
is it critically beloved? Or is it just that the kids that went and saw the movie are critics, you know, different people?
I'm sure that has something to do with it, but that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, it's critically beloved now.
Because that's a good point. You talk about standing the test of time... But maybe it's just a generational thing. A 15-year-old that sees something in the theater now becomes the head of the website 10 years later and now says, this is my favorite movie, and everyone,
how do you function with just this seething, boiling, like, bilious cynicism?
It's not cynicism.
It is, constantly. You can only answer anything anyone says with, like, oh, it's probably, that's probably what it is, yeah. And then, like, and that cements it in your mind that that's what it is, because you're offering answers to yourself, and then you're jumping at them like this, like another person was the one offering them to you.
Okay. And it's disturbing how often I'm right. Right?
It's bilious.
Well, no. I mean, I asked it as I framed it as a question, though.
No,
I mean,
it's not. It's not. Whatever you said, it is. It's not. That's not what it is. It's that. In retrospect, people love it.
It's the same critics.
It's not like it's the same critics. It's not like all the people who watched it when it came out were 78 years old and soon to die and had to be replaced with 20-year-old critics. That's not what happens.
Okay. No,
there's not a cultural shift where they all drop off like that.
There is a cultural.
There might have been five major critics who are gone since then, and there might be five new critics.
Right.
But
things do shift.
But it doesn't matter. The point is that people who hated it are now saying they don't hate it anymore.
Okay, if that's verifiable.
Because on repeat viewings and having gone back, they now understand about it, you know.
Okay.
So the thing about criticism is you're giving a knee-jerk reaction to something, and
usually,
it's kind of unfair. But that's the name of the game.
We try to do our best here at the Futile Podcast to note those things.
Yeah, but our
things
opinions change as well.
They do change, but I'm saying we note that. Every single time, and you poo-poo it, but every time I review something, if I feel that there was something that may have negatively or overly positively affected it in my life or whatever, I mention it. And you're always like, that shouldn't count. That isn't. But I'm being human. I'm saying that as a human being, you know, if my cat died that day when I went in to watch this dour movie, I just wasn't in the mood for it. And so I found it incredulous. I have gone on record to say this I thought was better than the first time I saw it, you know? And that's important, I think. But my point was more about just how, I mean, the whole idea of standing the test of time is gonna take, it takes multiple generations, I think. It is something like a 100-year-old book or something, because otherwise it's just one generation this, one generation that. It almost is like musical genres where, I mean, it takes a while to know if a song is really gonna hit big with the kids. Of the kids.
I think they can tell pretty quickly if something's gonna hit big musically. And they can with movies also. I mean, it's a fast turnaround, but critically things are not so cut and dried. If something's just generally all around great and a big crowd pleaser, that's easy. But
right.
Like when it comes to something that's like artistic and harder to get a handle on, then
like
you're not. Then people may not know what they feel when
like
they are
advice.
Talking about it.
And that's easy. See, you posed the same question I did at the beginning of the podcast. I'm like, why did so many people not like this movie that I liked? What do you, you know? You read parts of the criticism, but didn't read all of them.
No, I'm glad that people didn't like it.
Why? Because then it's not like it's a hot girl that then you get a chance with because everyone else doesn't think she's attractive.
That's exactly what it is.
You get to be that one guy that's like,
no,
it's actually quite good. And if you don't understand it, I feel sorry for
you. No, I wouldn't do that to someone.
To
each his own.
To each his own.
People can like what they want to like. I'm fine with that. I like most movies I like. There aren't many movies I don't like. There aren't many movies I don't like. That's about it.
You just love the experience.
I love watching movies.
That's good. That's good.
Most movies are well made enough that that I get it.
That's good that it, at this far into doing movie criticism and just cultural analysis stuff, that you still have that just unabashed joy for the experience.
It is good.
I feel like I struggle with that a lot.
It's because you're a hater.
No, I'm not a hater. I have that narrative.
It's because
I'll have that, like, I go into certain things wanting to love them too much, and then that fails me. Or I go into other things thinking this is probably not good, and sometimes it ends up being better, and that's great. And sometimes it just ends up being what I thought, and that sucks. But I rarely go to a theater and pay good theater quality money to see a movie that I don't think I'm gonna like on some level, enough to think that's worth it. that's my take on that. I mean, I'll hang out with friends and watch a Steven Seagal movie at home, but I mean, if Rattlesnake Man 2 or whatever with Steven Seagal and Randy Couture and John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson and I don't know, came out to the theater and it was 2 hours and 17 minutes long, I wouldn't be clamoring to go see that. Speaking of which, Fury 7, we're there, right?
Yeah, I'll see it.
Oh, look at this. I'll see. See, now I'm all excited for it.
Why would you get excited?
You're just going to build it up.
You're going to build it up.
Because Transporter, Frank is in it.
They could have put anyone in it.
The Confluence. How many years?
Steven Seagal and Randy Couture.
Since the beginning of this podcast, I've been saying eventually Transporter and Fast and Furious is going to become one thing. And now I get that brass ring or whatever. 350 episodes in. That's right. Can you believe it?
350.
That's where we're at.
How many have been the A-team?
I don't know. Stats-wise, probably somewhere in the high 60s. There was we were very consistent for a while there. And we're getting more consistent now.
So maybe you should just kind of not count all those other ones as official episodes, and we'll say you're at like 260. 270 at the most. What about that?
Non-officials?
Yeah.
I don't know. No, I mean, the whole nature of the podcast is to get different people.
Oh, is it?
Bouncing things off of things. Yeah, I've even offered to be just a producer on something. Say, you know.
That's no good.
No, I guess not. Anyway, Inherent Vice, I think I give it a light 4 out of 5. Light 4 out of 5.
I give it a 4.
So you like it a little more than me. But not in a quantifiable.
There's no such thing as a light 4.
A light 4 means that, like, I give it a 4.
No,
but
you don't. No, you don't.
It means someone's got a gun to my head. They're like, give it whatever, 4.
Give it,
I'm
whatever,
like, okay.
Give it whatever number you want to give it. Give it a 3.9.
We don't do that here.
We can do that. We've done that.
No.
You can't say a light 4. You can't say a light 4. Seth also overrides scores and tells you what you really thought of something.
Doesn't he just, right?
I was told to tell you something about giving out for justice at least a 3.5.
Yes, I saw this on Twitter.
So, did you? Do you?
Our friend Jeff Phillips. Well, I think that Jeff understands that if we pander, if we kowtow, then we won't be the same podcast that he knows and loves. Does he really want a podcast like that? Does he really want to listen to people that will just look at the polls and tell the listeners
which one is out
for
justice again? That's the one where Steven Seagal kills all those guys.
It's the one where he's got that convincing Brooklyn accent.
Oh yeah,
and
what,
the, and the beret.
What did you give it?
I think I gave it a 3.
That one kind of sucked.
Actually, it stayed focused on what it was doing, and it wasn't too bad.
That's the one with Forsythe.
Forsythe. And
it's crazy.
Yeah, it does. It's got Jump the Fern, that song.
There's nothing about jumping a fern. It's shaking a fern.
Shaking
it's
the
shake
fern?
Shake the fern. It's not jump the fern.
Neither one of those makes any sense, though.
You shake the fern. The rats all come out of it.
The rats? Or do you like find like
heroin
needles
you
in
shake
there
the fern
something?
And then birds come out. And then you shoot the birds.
Whatever people do.
I imagine it's talking about that. What is jumping a fern?
I don't know. There's a fern in your way growing in the cracks of the Brooklyn sidewalk.
So you jump it?
You're running.
No, you shake the fern. That's the part where he's trying to winnow out all the trash. He's trying to find all the trash so they can lead him to Forsythe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does. And then he blows that guy's leg off with a shotgun.
Right. And he fights Styx?
Yeah, he does fight Styx. Poor Styx.
Styx did not do so well. Anyway, so that's my response to...
Do you remember what I gave it?
No. Do you? Because you got to do Letterboxd and you don't have to remember.
Nah,
you can just check.
Who cares?
And it keeps track.
It
for
doesn't
you.
Matter. It's out there for posterity. Why do I need to know what I gave something?
That's a good point. Other people will probably create some aggregate of the reviews and then do a total character profile.
On who?
On one of us, and then probably try to seduce us.
I hope it's me.
I hope it's you too. Uh-huh. That would be exciting.
Yeah. I can hardly wait. See what I'm doing.
I see what you're doing there, yeah. But channeling a little of Bjornsson.
Beer can, just like my buddy.
Bjornsson there, yeah. Here's to 350 more, huh?
Oh, jeez.